Grab your coffee and get ready, because today we're diving into a case that was highly covered by the media. There are tons of shows and movies about it. It's one of the most well-known cases to this day, not only because it involves a well-known actress and the Charles Manson cult, but also because the crimes were so heinous and there was very little justice after the fact. That's right, today I'll be telling you why Sharon Tate was so iconic and how her life came to a tragic end. Please be advised that this case is probably one of the most gruesome that I've ever covered, and usually I kind of blur that a little bit, but because there's so many movies and TV shows and podcasts about this case, I figured I'm going to give you the details, the gory details, unfortunately. So, with that being said, let's take to the notes. Sharon Marie Tate was the daughter of a U.S. Army officer and homemaker. She was born in Dallas, Texas in 1943 and was the oldest of three girls. Because of her father's job, she moved around many times as a child, and this made it hard for her to really build roots and relationships. This kind of shaped her into being a shy and self-conscious teenager, and though many thought that she was aloof, her beauty was something that always was noticed. She entered and won beauty pageants growing up, even at a very young age, and used this time on stage to talk about her love of things like psychiatry. Her great looks and eager attitude helped her land a role as an extra in the film Hemingway's Adventures of a Young Man, where she met and eventually dated Richard Baymer, who was one of the producers. This experience and his encouragement sparked her love for acting, and there was kind of a snowball effect after this as far as her career goes. She met many well-known names in the industry between 1960 and 1963. She was cast in Pat Boone's Chevy Showroom and Barabbas. She got herself an agent to represent her in both acting and modeling, and she signed a 7-year contract with Filmways Incorporated. She was often recognized by producers on set for her beauty, even when she was just cast as an extra. But she lost a lot of roles due to a perceived lack of confidence. And it's for this reason why many of her roles were smaller parts. She appeared on things such as Mr. Ed and the Beverly Hillbillies, but never really advanced into these major roles until much later. As she continued to pursue acting, she was in and out of relationships and had many suitors who proposed to her, even though she declined. And she said that the main reason why she was hesitant on getting married at the time was that she knew if she were to get married, she would retire from acting, and she believed that she still had a long way to go. At first, it seemed like this was all for nothing, as she was getting rejected for many roles, even though she auditioned for so many things, like The Cincinnati Kid, The Sound of Music, The Sandpiper, but she kept trying. In 1965, this all worked out for her, and she got her first big role in Eye of the Devil, which also led to a documentary being created about her called All Eyes on Sharon Tate. And this documentary was set to be co-released with the film as a sort of cross-promotion. In the documentary, the producers discuss how they doubted her at first, but she proved herself. And she did so in the press interviews as well. She traveled around the world from London to France to LA to do press and to shoot the film. And this is where she met Roman Polanski. And Roman was friends with a man named Ransoff, who was producing a new film called Fearless Vampire Killers. He recommended Tate for the role, and she was granted it. She would play alongside Roman, who was also starring in the film. And though they clashed heads at first, especially during filming, they really grew to like each other and even started dating. Eventually, they would move in together in London. Now, she was intertwined closely with huge names in the industry and was drawing a ton of attention. As Polanski was filming Rosemary's Baby, Sharon would come to visit the set, and photos of her would be taken by paparazzi, which increased the film's popularity even more. She was interviewed by high-profile publishers on her off time, and most notably, she'd be interviewed by Playboy, who would share nude photos of her and partially nude photos of her. And around the same time, she confided in her close friends, saying that she was actually in love with Polanski, likely because he saw her and cared for her before her career started and before she was hypersexualized. When asked about how she felt about her body being shared with everybody and being such a large focal point of her fame, she said, quote, I have no qualms about it at all. I don't see any difference between being stark naked or fully dressed. If it's part of the job and it's done with meaning and intention. I honestly don't understand the big fuss over nudity and sex in films. It's silly. On TV, the children can watch people being murdered, which is a very unnatural thing, but they can't watch two people in a natural process of making love? Now really, that doesn't make any sense, does it? Unquote. But reviews of her acting were very hit or miss, despite her body being shown so much. Critics either said she was the star of the show or she was completely unmentionable. And while reviews were mixed, her love life was not. She and Polanski went back to London together, where they would later get married in 1968, and though she saw him as the love of her life, he was not faithful during their marriage. He says it's just who he is, and she accepted that. And it really was a downward spiral from there. He wanted her to stop acting and cut ties with her industry connections. He said he wanted to be married to a hippie and not a housewife. So she followed him back to LA, where they would get a house in Beverly Hills. And Wikipedia says their house was a revolving door at the time. There was a constant flow of strangers coming in and out of the house, and her friends believed that she was much too trusting. Maybe she allowed this lifestyle so she could continue to pursue acting. Around the same time in 1968, she was cast in The Wrecking Crew and was even taught how to do stunts by Bruce Lee himself. This led to a Golden Globe Award for the new Star of the Year. She was nominated and runner-up for many other awards, and because she was being recognized so much, she was able to negotiate larger salaries for her future jobs. So at this point, things were really looking up for Sharon Tate, both in her career and in her personal life, when in 1968, towards the end, she became pregnant with her first child. She and Polanski moved to 150 CeeLo Drive in LA and loved the house. And it was in that house where this tragedy begins. Sharon was alone in LA at the time, and her husband was off filming but was supposed to return to the house on August 12th to be back in time for the child to be born. In the meantime, he asked two of his friends to stay at the house with her. Then on August 8th, just 4 days before her husband was supposed to return home, the crew returned to the house after having dinner together. Little did they know that four of Charles Manson's followers were also scoping out the house. Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Linda Casaban, and Patricia Kenwinkle were given specific instructions by Manson himself to, quote, totally destroy everyone in the house and do it as gruesome as you can, unquote. Mind you, at this point, Sharon was almost 9 months pregnant. She was also with her good friend, Jay, who she had dated in the past, and her husband's friend and his wife. Just past midnight on August 9th in 1969, the Manson followers would approach the house and cut the phone lines. They kept their cars out of sight and made their way to the house on foot. It's said that they climbed the back fence when they saw a car's headlights, so they hid in the bushes. They realized that someone else was on the property that night. Stephen Parent, an 18-year-old who was visiting the property's housekeeper. This was the first person that the group came across, and trigger warnings began right here. Watson held a gun to Parent's head as he pleaded for his life, and then Watson lunged at him with a knife and shot him 4 times. Overkill is pretty much this group's MO. Watson then got into the house by cutting the window screen and entering that way. He let the rest of the group in through the front door. Their whispers woke Frykowski, and they proceeded to kick him in the head, saying that they were the devil and they were here to do the devil's business. They then went around the house to find the others who were sleeping and brought them all into the living room. They tied Tate and Sebring together by their throats, and Sebring told them to be careful with her as she was pregnant. When he said this, Watson shot him. Meanwhile, Folger was asked about money, and when she said that she could only give them $70 in cash, they stabbed her 7 times. Frykowski had freed himself from the restraints on his wrist and lunged towards the group. He put up a good fight, but he was attacked from the back with a knife and shot 2 times. Folger was alive at this point and managed to escape and go to the bedroom. Since she was injured, she was moving pretty slow, and they caught up to her. In total, she was stabbed 28 times. Frykowski was stabbed 51 times and was hit in the head 13 times with a gun. He was hit so hard that the gun's grip actually broke off, and it was later recovered at the scene of the crime. Tate was the last one left at this point. she begged them to take her and leave the baby, but they didn't accept her pleas. They stabbed her a total of 16 times, and following Charles' orders, they used her blood to write the word pig on the wall. Sharon Tate was only 26 at the time of her death. The next morning, Sharon's housekeeper came by and discovered the bodies. She called the police right away, but it took months before Charles Manson and his followers were identified for the crime. This is completely shocking because the next night they practically did the exact same thing. And those murders are known as the LaBianca murders, which you can look up, but they were done pretty much the same. They were apprehended when one of Charles' followers, who was already in jail, started bragging to other inmates about the crime that had been committed. Following the crime, there were lots of back and forth on who did the killing of each person. The cult members seemingly wanted to take ownership to their cellmates, but not to a jury. In the end, all five members of the group were tried and convicted for the murders. At first, they all received death sentences, but in 1972, this was ruled unconstitutional, so instead, they were given life with the possibility of parole. So now, I'm going to give you a breakdown of each person's sentence and where they stand today. I want to state these notes were pulled directly from Wikipedia. All of my sources are linked in my show notes as always, so if you want to do some more digging, please feel free. Susan Atkins remained in prison until her death from brain cancer at age 61 in 2009. At the time of her death, she was California's longest-serving female inmate. Atkins had been denied parole 14 times, and her request for compassionate release had also been denied. Patricia Krenwinkel was imprisoned in 1971 and still remains incarcerated. Following the 2009 death of fellow Manson gang member Susan Atkins, she's now the longest incarcerated female inmate in the California penal system. She's been denied parole 14 times, most recently in 2017. Charles Manson remained imprisoned until his death from cardiac arrest resulting from respiratory failure and colon cancer on November 19, 2017. He was just a few days from his 83rd birthday and had spent all but 13 years of his life in some sort of supervised setting. While in prison, Manson had been denied parole 12 times, and after 1997, he refused to attend any of his own parole hearings. Leslie Van Houten was 21 when she was convicted and sentenced to death. She became the youngest woman ever put on California's death row, as well as the youngest member of the Manson family convicted of murder. Currently incarcerated, she's been denied parole 22 times, most recently in 2019. At her three most recent parole hearings, she was actually approved by the parole board, but in each case, the parole board's decision was overturned by the California governor. And finally, Charles Tex Watson remains incarcerated. He's been denied parole 17 times, most recently in 2016. And while imprisoned, Watson claimed that he had become a born-again Christian. This case captivated the nation and really the world. It was like a never-ending nightmare full of cults, murder, fame, and a lack of justice. Every piece of it makes your brain hurt and makes you question humanity. Following the murder of Sharon Tate and her friends, many movies and TV shows were made, such as Aquarius, Charlie Says, Season 7 of American Horror Story, The Haunting of Sharon Tate, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. In the later film, it depicts Manson as a vengeful man who had aspirations of being a musician and wanted to record with Terry Melcher, who once lived in the house Sharon was in when they killed her. But when Melcher refused this deal, Manson became enraged and wanted revenge on Hollywood in general. Many thought Polanski was the original target, but that is untrue. It was less about who was killed and more about when it happened. That is, for Charles Manson, at least. And like many things that are hard for humans to wrap their head around, the crime scene location has become somewhat of a tourist attraction. The house on Celio Drive has a long history of very famous residents, but the house's owner has to be the worst. After the murders, when photos were released of the crime scene, the house's owner, Al Tobelli, sued Sharon's family for damages on the house and sued her husband for allowing photos to be released, claiming it would hurt the resale value of the house. He sued her family for $500,000 and was granted just a little over $4,000. In 1992, the house was listed for about $5 million and was rented for $11,000 a month to the Nine Inch Nails frontman, who recorded their album, The Downward Spiral, from the house's living room. The new owners changed the address and the look of the home. At its height, the house was valued at about $12 million. Though this is a solved case and everyone involved is either long gone or will never be released from prison, there is no justice for such a senseless act. That's it for this episode. If you have thoughts on this episode or want a specific case covered, write in by DMing me on Instagram @MeganTheMorningPodcast. And I'll see you back here in 2 weeks.